I'm Jordan King, and you're listening to Formula Nerds Podcast.
It's lights out and away we go!
Hello and welcome to the Cut to the Race podcast. Today on the show, we have a very special guest. But before I introduce him, we have Michael on the show. How are you, Michael?
I'm good, thank you. I'm good. First time?
First time for everything. Welcome along. We have Dan, the Bottas fan. How are you?
I was wondering if you were still going to say that, given we're not talking about anything to do with Bottas today, but yeah, I'm very good, thank you.
I had to, that's how people know you now. We have a special guest by the name of Jordan King. How are you, sir?
Yes, I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Yes, I'm great, thank you. For our listeners who don't know who you are, can you explain yourself in one sentence for us?
As a racing driver, I am probably quite a diverse racing driver in the sense I've raced in LMP1, LMP2, IndyCar, Formula 2, tested Formula 1. So I've done a little bit like that. As an actual person, I'm just an avid sports fan in general.
I was just thinking when I said the one sentence thing, that was a little bit unfair because of all the different things that you've done. So can you tell us a bit about your career today? I know you've just told us a little bit, but how have you actually got to where you are today?
Well, I think if we go back a bit further, I always go back a little bit further than motorsport. I always wanted to be a sports person from, you'd speak to my dad. It was like, as soon as I could walk, I was already catching and kicking and throwing balls. So as long as I can remember, I've loved sport, I've enjoyed sport, and I've wanted to be involved in sport in some manner. I suppose a normal child, if there is such thing. I played rugby, football, cricket. I suppose for people around in other countries, maybe that's not the normal three sports that you play, but obviously in the UK, they're the main three. But you know, I've sailed, I've skied, I've done all that stuff. So yeah, I was always into my sport. And when I was 11 years old, I went to a Rive and Drive indoor karting place not far from down the road from where I live now, actually. And called Mr. Karting. They've just moved due to COVID, but enjoyed myself. And I suppose I should say my sister actually beat me first time. But I put it down to the fact she was older and in the bigger karts. So we'll accept that one as part of it. But yeah, from there on... it was that kind of year that everyone went karting for their birthdays and did a little bit here and there. And the owner of the place, Alan, said to my dad, you've been here a dozen times now. If you want to do a bit more, this is kind of the next step. So my dad looked into it and then, started karting from there. And to skip forward a few years, you go up through the karting ranks and won my first race. And as soon as you kind of win your first race, you realize you've got the bug then step into cars and then you do the same thing again. You've kind of go back to square one and work your way up the car ranks until you get as high as you can, basically. And that, in short, is probably how I got myself into motorsport and why sport was where I leant on from a young age.
So when you were racing in Formula 3, Formula 2, karting, any of the junior categories, was there a driver that you looked up to, whether it was an F1 driver, an IndyCar driver?
No, this sort of question is being asked a lot within people within motorsport and also just people from out of motorsport. I don't tend to have idols in that sense. Yeah, I think the innocence of a child, my first probably idol was David Beckham and playing football. Up until 15 years old, I was still missing races to play football for my local club and rugby. And actually the week before I decided to stop playing rugby to kind of be full-time on the racing, I broke my collarbone. So So yeah, that confirmed to me which one I wanted to do. It's a bit of a slight tangent, sorry. But yeah, actually involved in motorsport. No, I've never really had an actual idol that I've looked up to. You know, people that I admire in general in life, I think. You know, people who have achieved great things, and not just in one aspect, in multiple aspects. You know, someone that comes to mind, like Seb Coe, for example. You know, not only did he achieve some great, you know, running feats, he's then carried on and heading up the IAAF now. You know, some businessmen, I'd like to say, you know, kind of my grandparents and my father are also, you know, idols in a different sense of who you look up to. But yeah, never particularly had someone other than kind of my childhood innocence that you like, oh, you know, you want to be like, sort of thing, as your own. Well, I've always found I'm my own person. And I suppose in motorsport, if you can pay yourself to someone, most of the time you end up racing against them at some point.
In racing itself, there have been some really weird and wonderful sponsorship partnerships that we've seen through from the prodigy guys in motorbikes and down to yourself racing with DC Jackie Chan. I think, did you ever get to meet him? What was that partnership like? How did that evolve and how did that come about in terms of a racing relationship?
No, never actually met Jackie Chan himself. I'm not sure which races he came to, but he never came to the ones I was involved with. But yeah, that relationship, to I suppose jump through a few hoops quickly, was there's a team in the UK called Jota. I'm sure you've heard of it. You know, very successful endurance racing team. And they ran that project for a guy called David Cheng and Jackie Chan, and they were the ones kind of heading it up. So, yeah, Sam Hignett at Jota is, I suppose, the man on the ground who was behind that project. You know, now they're running Jagonia IAM with Sean Glale and Antonio Felix da Costa, Anthony Davison in another car. I can't remember who is it Gonzalez and the third driver in the other car. So yeah, they've now still got two cars, but they're funded by other projects.
That's really cool.
You've already explained that you've done quite a few things in your time. Now, what would you say has been sort of your greatest achievement, and tell us why?
I think, well, in motorsport, that's a hard one.
I've got to just say to our listeners that can't see you, behind you is the biggest trophy cabinet I've ever seen. So, yeah, which one's your favourite and why?
Well, out of, I've got a little, not the one that's behind me, next to my desk. I've actually got a few framed things. This is kind of my achievements. And there's only actually two motorsport things on there that are my achievements. There's one is all my passes from when I drove an F1 car, so I've got those all framed, and the other one is my first ever win back in 2007, I think it is. I could quickly run and tell you the exact date, but that's my first ever win, and it was 11 months after I started racing properly. And to name a few names on there that you might know, you know, it's like Jake Dennis, Alex Albon. Yeah, so we're all 10-year-olds, or well, I would have been about 12 then, I think, actually. Maybe they were a little bit younger than me. But yeah, that was the first ever win. And actually, if you look at it, probably best part of 5 or 6 people on that grid as 10 to 12-year-olds have all gone on to race and some really good things. So yeah, that's kind of my first win has been the greatest achievement, because you start from nothing. When you start from nothing to get to a winning level, and against people that now, you know, were good back then, but they've been confirmed in what they've achieved since then. And then obviously my F1 passes, they're the only two kind of achievements I've got in a more personal section. As you say, behind me, I've got, I think I counted them the other week, 130 trophies, or 129, maybe I've rounded it up slightly to lie. But Yeah, so to pick one of those, you know, is very hard. From an actual win that was another kind of standout, I think, performance and a moment was winning the British Grand Prix in GP2. Because yeah. I had like 40 of my sponsors and partners there and family and friends, and it kind of really showed how far I'd come. You know, everyone that supported me financially along the way with partnerships and sponsorships were there. And then, you know, family and friends who supported me, I suppose, more physically and emotionally were there. And it was just a really cool weekend and one of those that you'll remember.
I've got to be honest with you. I remember it. I was there. I was cheering you on. I remember it like it was yesterday, which is it's crazy. And now we look at you, and you're the simulator driver for Alpine F1. What for our listeners? What exactly does that role involve?
So the role within Alpine, I'm not the only one that does the role. They have their academy drivers, which they lean on quite a bit. So Christian Lundgaard, I think, is their main one that they lean on from within their academy. And then there's also myself and Oliver Rowland, the two kind of shoo-ins, I suppose. Over the winter, it's very much pure development. I know that sounds silly, but going through all the future stuff, what's in the pipeline for a week ahead, what's in the pipeline for a month ahead, what's in the pipeline for 6 months ahead, or even a year. You get 1 week is one department kind of send you a load of stuff, and then another week is another department send you a load of stuff. I think we'll be careful what I'm actually allowed to say to you guys.
Don't worry about that.
Yeah. But then, so like this weekend, I was on the sim doing the race support for them. So then that's very actually kind of the here and now trackside support, send us all the stuff. We're then back at the factory going through all of their data, correlating it, doing setup changes, trying to maximize everything we can to send it back to the track. So there's actually quite a lot of, you know, energy goes into the process back at the factory to try and make the cars just that one or two tenths faster at the racetrack.
And how do you find that the crossover comes? Because obviously you're a development driver for Formula E as well. How do you find the two disciplines kind of mix? Is there anything that you can carry from one to the other, or is it a very separate discipline? Because I know Formula E is very new. Well, it's not very new, but it's still very young. It's in its infancy, I would say. How do you find that as a term to Formula One?
They are quite a bit different. Well, fundamentally, you just look at Monaco, you know, they were 20 seconds a lap difference. I don't actually see that as kind of how slow Formula E is. I see it more as how fast Formula One is. You know, Formula One is ridiculously fast these days. You know, even on the sim, sometimes you're like, this is just silly corners that should be more of a corner and not corners anymore. Whereas, you know, Formula E now, they're making really big progress for Gen 3, Generation 3 car. They're going up to 450 kilowatts, if I get that right. I'm sure someone out there will tell me I'm wrong. But, you know, a lighter car and a bit more downforce, a bit more grip, more power. So, you know, they're going to start getting really quite quick, which is, I think, good. But then also it's all about the electric tech.
Yeah.
As from a driving standpoint, you know, the fundamentals are the same. You've got a steering wheel, your bum's in a seat, and your 2 feet are pressing pedals. So, yeah, you're turning left and right, and you get oversteer and understeer. So that side of things is very similar. But then the process is completely different. You don't have gears in Formula E, for example, where you obviously got eight in Formula One. But actually, the driver load in Formula E is probably quite a lot higher just because there's so much other things going on. But then physically and mentally, it's probably more tiring in F1 just because of the speed. You know, your brain has to work seven times faster just to keep up with the images that are flashing past your eyes.
Yeah,
where Formula E, you know, is a bit slower, but there's much more going on. You're changing a lot more. You're managing a lot more. So yeah, fundamentally they're the same. It's a race car, but then also, you know, driving a race car versus driving a car on the road, it's fundamentally the same, but they're completely different things, if you know what I'm trying to say.
Yep. Gotcha. Yes, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was, I think it was about a month ago, we were talking to Sam Bird on this podcast, and he was saying the biggest sort of challenge that he's had going from naturally aspirated engines into Formula E was the regeneration. And actually, it's not about how fast you're going in Formula E, it's about how much speed you don't lose. Do you find that in what you're doing?
Yes, you know, the development stuff that I'm doing is not so lap time sensitive because I'm not qualifying. I'm not, you know, not racing against people. So I'm not quite as lap time sensitive, and it's very much about the efficiency and how easy it is to drive, you know, what changes we can make and all of that sort of stuff. But yeah, I think as Jeremy Clarkson once said on Top Gear was, the best way to be fuel efficient is just don't brake. So let's all just drive around without pressing the brakes. And in theory, that's it in the road car.
Yeah.
You know, when you're trying to get more miles per gallon, actually when the person in front of you brakes, it's really frustrating. And yeah, you've got to try and be as smooth as possible. Going sideways, you're losing energy. You want the energy to go forward, which is the quickest way. You know, in Formula One, normally aspirated engine, well, not, they're not normally aspirated, but you know, they've got fuel. To just burn, and actually burning an extra kilo of fuel throughout a race doesn't harm the efficiency or lap time. So actually a little bit of wheel spin doesn't matter, but actually in Formula E, that's wasted energy. You know, when you view something as energy, it's the same way, you know, we're all insulating our homes now and trying to make boilers more efficient. It's the same concept as all of that, but you just flipped over to a race car where you don't want to waste energy. You can regen as much as you can, try and brake as little as possible, roll as much speed through the corner, and don't go sideways or slide the car.
So are you that guy that wakes up with 100% on his iPhone and by the end of the day you want 1% just before you put it back on charge?
I would say I'm that sort of guy because I'm probably a little bit OCD in that sense, that I'll judge myself all the way throughout the day and ration my usage to make sure I get there. But yeah, I don't think that's got anything to do with Formula E. I think that's just my character.
As we've already alluded to throughout the podcast, you've raced in all different series. Your trophy cabinet behind you proves that. But if you had to pick one car from one of the series, which is your favourite that you've ever driven? And then also, which one is the most physically demanding? Because obviously they're two very different things.
Yes, that's a tough question. I think purely from the basis that every car has been great to drive for different reasons. You know, for me, driving a Formula One car was amazing, and it was a life, you know, life target, and a lot of sacrifice and energy had gone into getting myself there. But it probably wasn't the best car to drive because everything I ever did in it was testing, and you know, sometimes you've got 40 kilos of fuel on board, and then you're on old tires, and you know, you don't have a pure kind of, you just go out, test, drive as fast as you can. I only ever did one lap, I think, where I was below 30 kilos of fuel. I had soft tires on, or the softest tires on that weekend, and turned up to one of the better engine modes. And that was the first time in my career that I actually, well, excuse my French, in the helmet went, oh shit, this is fast. You know, it was the only time I've ever actually gone, that's, you know, like, whoa, you know, that's quick. And even, you know, as a child coming up, you first jump into something bigger. Never did you, you know, go full throttle and you're like, oh, this is actually almost scaring me. So, you know, Formula One from that sense is amazing. From a one lap side of things, actually, you could get a really nice car, really, really nice to drive and extract performance out of the old Formula 3, proper, what I would call proper Formula 3, because that's what I did. You're really high downforce, a little bit low on power, and you could just get a really nice aero balance for that one. Similar with GP2, whatever it was, the 2012 car, I think it was, a 2013 car, something like that. when I was doing it, you know, 15, 16, you could get quite a nice balance from car. And that was nice. And the engine was really good. So they were, you know, they were quite nice to drive over one lap. But then you mentioned kind of physicality and everything. Then IndyCar was, you know, that's cool. It's 750 horsepower, I think. But they're real racing engines, you know, two manufacturers fighting against each other. It's not a spec engine. So, you know, they were sharp. They were racy engines, which were really nice to drive. The only downside with that car, it was quite heavy. You know, slow corners, it was really hard to get a nice balance and be able to rotate the car nicely and get an exit. But for that one lap in qualifying with new tires and low fuel, it was a real nice to drive. And they're always on strange places, you know, tight, bumpy street circuits. So actually from a challenging standpoint, it was really nice to do. And growing up in Europe, all the tracks were new to me as well. So as a personal challenge, that was really good. But then you go to, you know, LMP1, LMP2, you know, this is a long answer. You know, they're very similar cars, not massively different, just a bit difference in performance. They were quite nice to drive. You could get a really nice balance with the car. You could extract quite a lot. With it being endurance, the tyres lasted quite a long time. You could lean on them, you could abuse them and not get too much kind of punishment from it. And the racing is really cool. You know, when you wake up at 2 a.m. in the morning to jump in a car in the middle of the night and it's freezing outside and you've not really slept for more than 10 minutes, like it's a cool thing to do. It's a cool thing to drive. And, you know, you go from scorching weather down to midnight. And yeah, I think it's a really hard one to say that one car is so much better. They've all got good things and bad things about them, if you know what I mean.
So you mentioned sort of the heaviness of IndyCars around slower corners. Does that in any way link to F1? What are the big differences between the two series in terms of, from your perspective, being in the cockpit?
Well, you remember when I drove Formula One, it was back in 15, 16? Yeah, they're quite a bit different to what they are today. And the cars are heavier today, but they've probably also got 30% more downforce, bigger tyres, more power. You know, they're the same engines, but they've probably got an extra 150 horsepower now that they've managed to extract out of them. I don't think when I drove them, they were over 900. And I think now they're creeping up to about 1,000. I might be wrong. They might have been over 900 when I drove them. But either way, they've extracted a bit more performance out of them. Where IndyCar, you know, is a good 200 horsepower less and actually probably a little bit heavier. But it was only a turbo. It wasn't a hybrid. So the power delivery was quite different. And you didn't have all the funky gadgets that you do on a Formula One car that makes it nice. It was a bit more raw. So from a driving experience, it was really cool because you had to hustle the car and really had to work hard. Where Formula One, although the lap time, you know, you put Formula One versus IndyCar, around COTA, I think they were like 15, 20 seconds quicker. You know, they're in a different league, Formula One. But they're kind of too nice to drive. From pure performance, as a racer driver, you want to go quick through the corners. And going flat through Puan at Spa is just ridiculous how you can even get you. Yeah, when I did about two laps flat in Formula 3 when I had a headwind on new tires way back when, and that was 250 horsepower and felt like, oh, this is quick. And now they're going flat with 1,000 horsepower. It's just stupid. It's not stupid, it's just really cool. IndyCar a bit different. You know, it's lower downforce, still a very high downforce car for what it is. 750 horsepower, a little bit less, but very punchy, very racy engine. But yeah, as you said, just a heavy car. It was just a bit labored. I suppose the way you could describe it for the viewers is probably like driving a one series BMW and then going into a Defender. You know, that. It's just a bit lazier, a bit heavier, takes longer to rotate the car, a bit longer to stop the car. It's just not quite as sharp, purely from the fact that, you know, it's got an extra 100 kilos. You put a backpack on and sprint down the road with 10 kilos in it, it feels slow. You take the backpack off, you're quicker again. You know, it's as simple as that, really.
Indy 500's got to be up there as one of the best ones.
Oh, as a sporting event, yeah. That's, you know, when you're involved in a sport, I don't see it as a sport in the same way I see rugby or football, you know.
Yeah.
For me, I would be waking up at stupid o'clock to watch the Rugby World Cup final and do everything I can to, like, get a ticket to the final or whatever. You know, I engage with it as a pure fan, where with motorsport, yeah, for me, it's not like that. And it's very much a job. It's very much it's a process to achieve something. So you disconnect the emotional part quite a lot. You do lose it. And I think that's, you know, when I actually got myself to Formula One, I almost had to stop and just take a breath and pinch myself and go, as a child, if you put me here now, I'd be like wetting myself. So to actually kind of re-engage that emotion is quite a different thing. I think you see that with sportsmen when they do finally achieve what they do, they then do break down, or if they fail, they then break down in a different way. And I think I probably was guilty of doing the same thing. And it wasn't until kind of after I did the Indy 500 that you realize at what level that is on a global scale. You know, they have a single day sporting event. It's got the most attendance in the world. They have over 300,000 people. You know, if someone had said to me, like, I'm getting goosebumps, like, thinking about it now. And if you said to me as a 10-year-old, oh, you'd walk out to Wembley with 90,000 people watching you play football, I would be like, this is the world's greatest thing. But yeah, I did it to three times that in my respective sport. So it's a strange feeling when you're actually so engrossed in something and you don't actually appreciate what it means to you personally, but also what it means to lots of other people out there. And I suppose it's quite a naive and selfish, I suppose actually arrogant way of looking at it, because you get so engrossed in the process and wanting to achieve more and more and more, you actually lose the realism of what you're doing at the time.
That's really interesting, because I love the Indy, and the Indy 500, you look at it and from a crowd point of view, that's it. That's like the pinnacle. It's like that's
a
really
sporting point of view.
Yeah. So to hear like the driver's point of view on it, and to how you can remove yourself from that, and to be able to remove yourself, that's really, really interesting.
Don't get me wrong. When you're standing on the grid and they've got B2 bomber flying over and fireworks going off and 300,000 people cheering, like, it is a buzz. You do realize what's going on, but you really have to switch that brain off. Yeah. When you're getting in the car and like you're driving down 240 miles an hour into turn one with 33 other cars and 200,000, 300,000 drunk Americans shouting at you. It's like with a wall only 3 meters away, you've got to kind of be process driven. Otherwise the whole thing gets a little bit overwhelming.
So you've driven in lots of different formats as well. So you've done the sort of the sprint races, and you've done the 24 hours of Le Mans. You've done all of this. Which ones really excite you? Because they are completely different, aren't they?
For me, it's actually just competing. You know, even when I have my weekends off, I go and do triathlons and run for my local athletics club. Although it's, you know, amateur sport, and you know, I'd be doing well to be able to go and run at a national level. I enjoy just the competition in everything I do. You know, as a kid, parents said, you know, the only way we could ever get you to do anything was make it a competition. You know, if we were coming into the car, leave for the day, and my dad had forgot his jacket, and he'd be like, oh, I forgot a jacket. And, you know, mum's like, we'll go in and get it. He's like, oh, I can't be bothered. And they just went, oh, you know what, oh, Jordan, do you want to get a jacket? And I'm like, no. Oh, we'll time you, so then off I run. You know, so for me, it just, it's competition. I remember with the Motorsport UK, and they had the kind of Team UK Elite program, and we were in Chamonix with a load of the drivers, and Jack Harvey was on my team, and we were abseiling down this thing and down the cliff. And he was like, I have never seen someone that's so competitive. Like, you literally would have killed yourself just to win getting down that mountain. I was like, well, yeah, Mike, I've got to win. So although each thing has its own excitement, it's the competition. You know, endurance stuff is mega. And actually from a personal challenge, it was quite new to me. And exciting and a different challenge because it's not just kind of completely flat out for that hour. You're flat out like an hour and 40 minutes. So you have a massive dump of adrenaline. You get out of the car, you have an hour and a half, 2 hours off. You've got to like recover and then go again, have another massive dump of adrenaline. So actually probably from getting the, you know, the chemicals that make me happy, it was really good because you get a massive dump of it every couple of hours, where with the sprint racing, you just get one real large, large dose of it once a day. So from that side, the endurance racing is probably better for me as a person. my dad once said, back much younger, crashed out of the race, on lap two or something. And he used to say that I was unbearable for the rest of the day because I just hadn't released that energy. You know, you build yourself up and then it's like you stop, but you've then still got all this energy up here and you don't have the kind of the achievement at the end to release it all. So for me it's just being competitive.
I think was it on your Le Mans race where, forgive me for talking about this, but you was it 195 laps and then was it a DNF?
Yeah, we had a fourth gear decided to explode. So one bit went forward, went through the gearbox into the engine. Another bit went out the side of the gearbox casing. And the third bit stayed in the gearbox, just rattling around, churning everything into soup. That was hour 14. And I just had my 20-minute nap. I think it was 3 a.m. in the morning, roughly speaking. I was got my stuff on and Ricky Taylor was due to come into the pits that lap, and then I just heard on the radio he's like, I've got no gears. He rolled back into the pits and they took the engine cover off, and it was it wasn't pretty.
Were you unbearable for the rest of that day?
probably. Even though, I went to go to sleep. And I fell asleep and got about 2 hours sleep and then woke up at, whatever it was, 6 a.m. and then didn't go back to bed until that night. But I hadn't slept since, Saturday morning at 7 a.m. So there was obviously still a lot of juices flowing around in my system because I didn't get much sleep until till Monday night.
I'm starting to understand you a bit now, I think.
Yeah.
you're a very experienced man when it comes to racing. You know, you've spoken about even how Formula 3-2 has changed since you were in it. So if I had a little figurative motorsport time machine that could take you to any era of racing to race in any discipline, where would you go?
I would say 2004-05 Formula 1. When they were, V10s.
They sounded lovely.
But they were only about 600 kilos, the car, so they were stupidly light. You know, today they're up at, 850, 900? They're quite heavy today. Don't quote me on that. That's a rough guesstimate. But, 04, 05, that kind of era, they were V10s, stupidly light, really small as well. When you see pictures of the new cars versus the cars then, they're half the size. And there was a load of cigarette money in the sport, so drivers got paid a big wage. So that's good.
When in Abu Dhabi last year, when Alonso was doing his title-winning demonstration
exactly.
In that Renault.
Yeah, that was 06, wasn't it? 07.
Yeah. It was just beautiful. Anything around that era is the right answer. Yeah. So well done.
So if you could, you've spoken about which era you would drive in. You've obviously driven in a heck of a lot of tracks around the world, probably more than most racing drivers have. Can we have your top three?
No, because I don't have any.
Oh.
I don't have a favourite track. Again, this is normally a question everyone asks, and I honestly really don't. You've got some that you do enjoy a little bit more than others. But I don't mark off ones in the calendar and go, oh, I can't wait to get there. If you were to pressure me, I would probably give you a list of the last three tracks that I won at, because you have a better memory of, you know, better memory of those tracks, but they're not ones that I particularly prefer over anyone else.
I suppose each track is good in its own right for a variety of things. So I suppose
they're all a challenge for their own reason. You know, some of the most challenging circuits I ever raced on were the street circuits in America, you know, where they were bumpy and, you know, you'd come out bruised, covered in bruises just from bouncing around in the cockpit. I would say lower on the list of challenges and ones you enjoy are probably the more modern tracks that have been made by, I think it's an Austrian, is he Austrian or German? The guy that makes them, just to not say his name. A few nodding heads, so you know what I'm talking about. Yeah, they're just a bit boring, really, aren't they? There's just not a lot going on. And the old school ones are normally the better ones because the curbs are funky and there's the bumps. And, you know, I remember Hungaroring used to have a couple of little bumps in a few areas and you had to touch them in certain ways and manipulate the car over them. And that was just a really good challenge. When they're completely mill pond smooth, there's not that extra challenge there. So you maybe enjoy driving on the ones that are a bit more challenging, a bit more, just because it's harder and I like a challenge. But yeah, I can't say I prefer them more than another one.
Gravel trap or no gravel trap?
Gravel trap.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Bit of a topic of the moment, that one, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
I just don't get it. Just put gravel traps everywhere. Yeah.
No, I don't get it either.
Solves track limits, doesn't it?
It solves track limits, and it's more of a thrill. Like, it's no fun going through a corner. You're like, oh, if I have a little snap of oversteer, I'll just drive off. Like, yeah. It's not as difficult, is it?
Yeah. No, I totally agree with you. And, you know, there's been all this discussion recently, and I think it even got to putting an extra line on the track. I'm like, no, well, don't put the first one there in the first place. What's the point if we're not going to?
As I always say, no other sport in the world seems to struggle with its boundaries. So why are we the only one that can't seem to get a grip on it?
Hmm.
We're all in agreement that the white line's the edge of the track. So the white line's the edge of the track. As long as two wheels are still on the track, what's the problem? And now they're getting into this stupid thing of, oh, well, there's not an advantage to run off there. Well, why are the drivers going out there then?
Exactly.
If there was an advantage, the drivers wouldn't do it. And I'm saying that because I would do it if it was an advantage. So.
Given your role in Alpine and how passionate you seem to be about it at the minute, is there any plans for you to return to the paddock anytime soon?
I would love to. If anyone's got a job out there for me.
Yeah.
It's tough. Obviously, COVID's changed a lot of things with people's racing programs and everything. You know, manufacturers treading on ice a little bit. And it's made it hard. But there's plenty of drivers out there in my position. And there's plenty of drivers kind of younger than me coming up and plenty of drivers older than me trying to find places as well. So it's a tricky one. In a sport that's very money driven, it's hard when there's, you know, people bring sponsors or personal money, manufacturers funding things. It just becomes a real hard moving target. It's very different to other sports in that context.
Who do you think maybe that's just come into F1 in the last year or so? Who do you think's really got that spark? You know, the next Verstappen or the next Lewis? Who would you say? Probably no one because they're not Jordan King, right?
Yeah. There you go. That's my answer.
Okay, got it.
Nice and simple. If I was to move away from racing slightly and talk about your work with the Birmingham Children's Hospital, which you do a lot of fundraising for, can you sort of tell the listeners and us why that's so close to your heart and some of the work that you've done with them?
Yeah, so do you want the long story or the short story?
The long story.
Long story.
The detailed, okay. Nitty-gritty long story.
We'll take out some of the details, but... when I was 11 years old, my mum noticed a lump on the side of my stomach. Did I say 11 years? 11 months. which one, I can't remember which one I said, 11 months. When I was 11 months old, whichever one I said, 11 months old, my mum noticed a lump on the side of my stomach, and it was cancer. It just so happened the cancer that I had, the best, there was two specialist places in the world that specialised in the cancer that I had, one being in America and the other one being in Birmingham. So luckily for me, it was only 40 minutes down the road from where I lived. And it was Birmingham Children's Hospital. So yeah, within, I think it was 24 hours, might have been 48 hours of noticing the lump, I had an operation, had it all cut out, bit of chemotherapy and touch wood and all that. It never came back. So yeah, that would have been what, 26 years ago, just over 26 years ago now. I still stay in contact with the hospital quite a bit, as you mentioned. Actually, the consultant, Dr. Bruce Morland, who was the guy that kind of guided myself and, well, yeah, had to, 11 months old, but parents through the process. I still, you know, stay in contact with him on and off, and he's come to a few of my races. He's been to Silverstone a few times, so... Yeah, that's quite a cool thing to be able to have done. I suppose for him as well to notice kind of his lifetime achievements. We're talking about achievements. If I'm sure, there's very little time as a doctor you can see the final results and the gratitude for things. So yeah, so that that's quite a special one. I still don't know who did the operation. I've been told he lives down in Cornwall, I think. That's what I've been told, but I don't know his name. So anyone out there that operated on a small boy for a Wilms tumour 26 years ago wants to get in contact, they can. So yeah, any kind of fundraising I do for them. Same, my parents. You know, my dad's raised a chunk of money for them over the years. I try not to be too public with it because... I'm not doing it for my own recognition, but obviously it always becomes a bit of a topic of conversation. And I do lean on contacts and what I'm doing to try and raise money. So there is a bit of a shameless plug in there a few times. But I try not to kind of take it as it's me doing it rather than just I'm doing it for... for the hospital. Over the years, I've probably raised about £20,000. So a decent total so far.
That must be so nice for you, but so nice for the doctors as well. Because obviously they see thousands of people a year, most likely, but very few occasions do they really get to see their work in a few years' time and what it's done and what it means to you. So that must be quite rewarding for them to sort of see this...
I don't know. I think they do stay in contact with quite a lot of patients. One from development standpoint. I know I was still going into the hospital quite regularly. I didn't get fully kind of the all clear until about 12. I think I stopped going to the hospital. It went from being, I was in there kind of every day through to like once a week, once a month, once every 6 months, and then it was every couple of years. And then by the time I was 10, 12 years old, there was no more to be done. So I think they do still have a bit of a connection, but I have no idea what other patients have gone on to do. There's always a strong connection whenever I've done any fundraising. It's amazing how many people come out of the woodwork that have a connection to the hospital, whether it's friends and extended friends or just people you meet down the pub. You'd be like, oh yeah, I know someone that's either there or is going there. Their actual catchment area, I won't attempt to say the numbers because I'll get it wrong, but their catchment area is way larger than something like Great Ormond Street. And the amount of patients they have is, way larger. As I said, I can make up saying it's five times or whatever, but I can't remember. I did get told the numbers once. because it's so central to the country, you know, they get such a bigger catchment because they get everything up, you know, up north in Manchester and New York and then everything all the way kind of down to London. And yeah, that's why I think it's so connected to so many people, and they're always trying to raise more funds because of it.
Well, I think it's an amazing cause, and it's very touching how you're still in contact as well. I think there's something very special in that. Can you tell us then, Jordan, what's next for you? What are we going to see over the next few years? I know that's almost like talking about a time machine with the world that we're in at the moment. But where can we see you now, and where can we see you in the next few years?
Well, as I mentioned, Formula One development stuff on their sim for Alpine. And then Mahindra being the development role there, you know, they're pretty full-time things. So I doubt there's going to be much development through the Alpine side of things. They got an academy. I'm kind of on the other side of their academy, being the lofty age of 27 now. And then the Formula E stuff, there's potential to grow there for sure, whether it's with Mahindra. I don't know. That's, you know, how long's a piece of string. I'd love to get back into IndyCar, you know, working quite hard actually to try and get some sponsorship. And even if it's just to do the Indy 500 again, would love to be able to do it. But again, that's a moving target constantly. More than likely is World Endurance. You know, that looks like it's growing. It's going to be a good championship with this new hypercar and LMDH link up they're doing with IMSA and WEC. So there's potential there for something. But again, it's finding the right door, knocking on a lot of doors. I just don't have the key at the moment to open any of them. So yeah, I really can't tell you where I'm going to be racing wise, but yeah, doing plenty of coaching as well for some young drivers, which is quite rewarding to see them develop as they come through, and doing a bit of commentary for F1 TV. So between all of that, I'm actually pretty flat out. Just need a nice manufacturer to let me in.
Well, if you've ever got some spare space on the car during the IndyCar, we'll be happy to put our logo on there. I'm not sure how much money we can give you in return, but if you need a spare spot.
We can try and do a GoFundMe campaign and see how much we can get to.
It's not a bad idea. It really isn't a bad idea. Where can our listeners find you, follow you, and follow the world and the journey that you're on?
Well, I'm not the greatest on social media. Because I'm just not. I haven't got an excuse. I'm just not very good at it. Just busy doing other things. Across Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, I'm 42 Jordan King. I have actually managed to dig up some content this week, so you might be in a treat and actually get a bit of content for once. I suppose the big three. I'm not quite cool enough or young enough to be on any of the others like TikTok or anything like that.
I'm old.
No, I don't even know what TikTok is either. Don't worry.
Exactly. and then I've got my website, which probably has very limited stuff on it other than my social media posts at the moment, as a lot of the stuff I'm doing I can't talk about because it's all behind closed doors. So that's about it, really.
Okay. And it wouldn't be right to let you go, because we are on an F1 podcast. I mean, we will let you go, but without asking, as an insider, as a true racer, who's going to win the Drivers' Championship this year in F1, and who's going to win the Constructors?
Lewis Hamilton and Mercedes. That's a tough one.
Can't argue with that.
Dan Cry.
Yeah. No, for me, Lewis, the last few years has been exceptional. You can't deny actually what he's achieved, and people saying the Mercedes car is great, which it is, but they need to shut up really, because he's doing a really good job. And that's coming from a driver that normally would not want to give anyone credit, but he is doing a very good job. I think you can see that even when he's up against it, they find a way, and not just him, the way he is working with Mercedes and how they gel together is really impressive. You know, I think it's one of these times that you see, I think it was it the class of 96 at United where they won everything, and now people talk about that being the moment. You know, when, you know, my dad always used to talk at, you know, when we were go to a game or something and say, you know, a sportsman at the height of their pomp, and that expression definitely comes into play. You know, we saw it with Usain Bolt where no one could touch him. I saw it come up actually on Instagram today, Jonathan Edwards' birthday, and you know, he still holds a world record. Like, it's, you get a moment in time in particular sports where it just, they look like, they, it looks easy, they can't do wrong, where actually they're just doing a fantastic job. We saw it the weekend, they thought all their cars had been covered and they pulled out the ace at the end. And yeah, he's shown time and time again that he can do it. So, you know, Max is very good, clearly very quick, but he's not putting it together.
No.
You know, he should have won 3 races so far this year. And he hasn't. So if not, he probably should have won 4 this year, and he hasn't.
I've got one question for you. Should Bottas have got out of the way earlier?
I think so. But as it happens, it doesn't matter.
No, I don't.
Because he got him anyway. But also, I actually quite like Mercedes that they don't ever explicitly, you know, give the actual team orders. You know, back in the day with Ferrari, with Schumacher and Barrichello, it'd be like lap 2 of the race, and they're like, all right, move over, you know, crack on. Where they kind of let them race out, and it's only if they really need to. I think we saw in Hungary where they said, oh, Valtteri, can you let Lewis have a go? And then he let him pass back on the last lap. You know, I think Valtteri made it a little bit difficult. He knew it wasn't like they're on the same strategy. They knew, I think from, if I was running the team, I'd be a bit like, come on, Valtteri, you're on a completely different strategy. All you should have done was just, once he was there, you didn't have to back off to let him pass, but once he was there, just lose yourself 5/10 of a second. Where the move that actually happened, it was a half-hearted move that almost looked like we were going to crash.
Yeah.
I just think that just looks a bit silly, really, for everyone involved, that they should have just solved that a bit earlier, because it wasn't like they were racing each other either.
Mm. And do you think 2022 reg changes are going to bring some more spice to F1?
I hope so. I do hope so. But I'm not convinced they will, because the level of downforce these cars have got. If you want to watch really good racing, go down to your local kart track and watch a bunch of 10-year-olds drive around. It's the best racing you'll ever see. And they're nose to tail, and you have 30 cars literally pushing each other around. So if you want to watch good racing, go and watch a karting race. And they have no downforce and no power, but loads of grip. As soon as you start adding downforce into it and the level of downforce that they've got, unless you introduce artificial things and kind of arbitrary overtaking scenarios and devices, it's always going to be tricky. Formula E manage it, but purely from the basis that everyone's trying to save fuel. So it's a game of chess. You know, whenever you play chess, you're happy to lose a pawn as long as you still got your queen, for example. But as soon as you lose your queen, it's get, and that is what Formula E is. You know, it's how many pawns can you sacrifice and still have your strong players left at the end? And you see the drivers that use their queen and stuff a bit too early, and they struggle. So that's a completely different aspect, but creates really good racing. And actually, they're on circuits that you would think no one can ever overtake on. When you get to a pure form of motorsport like Formula One, where it's just as we would remember it for the last 100 years, when the brake zone's 50 meters, you try and brake 10 meters later, you've got to suddenly take, you know, a good 20% of the brake zone out of it. It's not, you know, like in karting, you can overtake someone from miles back because you can take 20% out, but 20% over 100 meters is completely different. I think it should make a difference in theory with the aerodynamics, but I'm not convinced it will. And I don't think it needs to a certain degree. As long as it's exciting, I think they can do it in different ways. They've got DRS now. I don't think they need to go too stressed. If they do pit stops, you know, with this sprint race that they're trying to introduce, I think actually it's not the stupidest idea in the world, but the way they've executed it, I think, is terrible. Because if you actually had it as you finish the race as you start the race on Sunday, maybe introduce refueling or not. But if you have to start the race on the tyres you finish, then if you're out of the points, you might get someone go, actually, I'll just pop in, whack a new set of tyres on with three laps to go. Yes, I might lose a couple of places, but I've got brand new tyres. And then the guys going for the championship, you know, the Mercedes, they'll still want to take the 10 points for the win or whatever it is. They might not go for those extra pit stops, go for the tyres. They get the points. They then start pole the next day. They've got a bit of advantage on the car and track position that they might be able to get to the first pit stop without the other guys overtaking them, for example. But it, I think it just adds a whole new dynamic that actually maybe the middle field, as we see, the middle of the grid is so competitive, while the front is so competitive, that actually putting that element in, as we saw with Tyway at the weekend, it was a really good race. So... I think it's just trying to spice it up too much where actually we're forgetting what the sport is.
We don't want to end up at Bernie putting sprinklers on the track.
Yeah, exactly. Right? Yeah. But I think there's also, you know, the way you always remember the past, like you always remember your childhood as the sunny days. I don't think I can ever remember a rainy day from your childhood, can you? So you always remember it in golden, tint. But actually today, Formula One's never been as close as it has. The whole field's only separated by 1.5 seconds, which I think is amazing. 1.5 seconds separate 10 different teams, all building a car itself, and 20 drivers driving them around. So it's as close as it's ever been. We've got a challenge all the way throughout the grid. And we all talk about how great, you know, the Senna and Prost days were at McLaren. So, yeah, but they were on pole by like 1.5 seconds. You know, that wasn't a competition. So we all talk about how great it is, but I actually think it's just the delusion of where your view is in history, because that wasn't competitive. Yes, we've written a great history book about it because it was two good drivers racing each other. But actually, throughout the grid, it was rubbish. Everyone else was racing for third place and not even close to racing for third place. Even at the most dominance of Mercedes, you know, you look at their win record, they don't come close to what McLaren achieved that year. But not only do they not come close, like, on the win record, they don't even come close on their performance delta to everyone else on the grid.
I think you've just made an absolutely brilliant point. I really do. And I hope that our F1 fans out there are excited for what we have and what's coming, because it's very easy to look at things with a negative view. But we, you know, there are things that aren't great, but there are things that are great as well. Jordan, I want to thank you very much for spending your time with us this evening. It's been great talking to you.
No problem at all. Thanks for having me.
And thank you to Michael and Dan as well.
Cheers.
Anytime. Thank you. Thanks, Jordan.
Thank you.
And Jordan, let's catch up again in a little while and see where you've ended up in a few months or so and have another chat. Our listeners, I'm sure, will absolutely love it. But thank you very much again.
No problem at all. Cheers.